Thank you, Nikita. So I'll really be talking about really cold material here, temperature less than 1,000 degrees or 2,000 degrees, all the way down to molecular gas, so tens of degrees. The poster child of this sort of work that we've done with my collaborators is Markern 231. I feel a bit like an imposter here by talking about the supermassive black holes. And so many of the galaxies I'll be talking about today are actually fairly massive and above this 10 to the 12 solar masses threshold. So Markern 231 is a poster child, and this is an artistic rendition of what we think is going on in this object, where the outflow is quite wide angle and unrelated to perhaps the jet that exists in this object. And it's heavily mass loaded, as this illustration tries to point out. The issue of the cold molecular phase has been on our mind for quite a few years now. This was I'm part of the David Letterman generation. So we had a top 10 in this article where we had three open issues and theoretical issues and seven observational issues. And in no particular order, number two was the issue of the molecular gas, how much of the molecular gas is actually affected by these winds. And we mentioned to our colleagues to look at radio data and look at the residual after fitting Gauss in, because there could actually be a lot of material there after removing the actual disk in rotation, as well as dust. But it was actually very hard to do at 2005. The sensitivity of the detectors were not sufficient. Also, the baseline, there were quite a few issues. But since then, as I'll show you, it's really taken off. So the plan is very simple. I'll just remind you of the results on neutral gas, because I want to compare what we see in the neutral atomic material versus the molecular material. So starting with the neutral atomic winds, Crystal has talked a little bit about that. But this is, again, going back in time a little bit, using the sodium. Really, the best statistics that we have in the local universe comes from this line all the way to redshift 0.5. We had independent studies led by Dave Rupke and Crystal. We largely agree on quite a bit of the details. And I tried to summarize the results here on one slide, but the point I want to emphasize is, first of all, that the detection rate of these neutral outflows is quite large, especially among the ULURGs, star formation rate above 100 solar masses per year. And there might be a trend where the star formation rate being lower, the detection goes down a little bit. And we actually think that that's due to the opening angle of these outflow. We actually think that the opening angles of the ULURGs is actually wider than the opening angles of the object with a more modest star formation rate. And that's also been shown to be true, at least at star formation rate a few tens of solar masses, where there's actually a dependence of the outflow velocity versus inclination. And that would not be apparent if there was not a collimation of the outflow. And we don't see that among the ULURGs. On the other hand, ULURGs are a mess. We can't really see, we can't really tell the inclination of a ULURG. Just wanted to point out also that the correlation or the trends between outflow velocity and star formation rate are really seen only when one includes, this is velocity versus star formation rate, they're really only seen when you include the dwarf galaxies. Without the dwarf galaxy having a range of three, four orders of magnitude in terms of star formation rate, we wouldn't see that sort of correlation. That's important because I want to compare with the results that we see with molecular gas. The other thing I wanted to point out is the mass loading factor. Just looking at objects with this sort of star formation rate in excess of tens of solar masses per year, the mass loading factor is actually not correlated, as far as we can tell, with sigma or V escape or V rotation. And has a fairly broad range at any given stellar mass of an order of magnitude. And then there's the famous or infamous question of whether or not this material that is moving at velocities of 100 kilometers per second is escaping the galaxy. If there's no halo drag, so just purely ballistic motion, we calculated in the 2005 paper that the escape fraction could be 5 to 20%. But of course, there is halo drag. These are the results of a merger, and so they encounter quite a bit of material as they go out, and they almost certainly reduce velocity. So it might actually pollute the CGM, and perhaps explaining some of the halo material that has been seen on fairly large scale. And I don't really think that it actually escapes all the way to the IGM. Now, one thing that is clear, though, is that we're talking about quite a bit of material. This is just from the old, sort of relatively old data now. But the numbers that we published were of order 10 to the 8, 10 to the 10 in the most extreme cases, and the kinetic energy of 10 to the 56, 10 to the 57 ergs. And this figure was trying to illustrate the fact that most of the mass that we detect here in this material is really entrained material. It's heavily mass-loaded, much larger than this dashed line, which would be basically just the material coming from the starburst. And then there's actually basically enough energy from the starburst to drive these winds, most of the winds. These were from long-slit data. But since then, we've expanded the survey to study IFU data, two-dimensional data. The other thing that we found out in 2010 with Hannah Krug, is a student in Maryland, is that CIFAR galaxies are not really particularly efficient at driving any of these neutral winds, sodium winds. But we knew there was more behind these data that actually was hidden. Looking at more carefully at some of these objects that were plotted in the previous slide, there were objects where, for instance, this object, Mercury 231, where we detected velocities, outflow velocity, again in sodium, so in absorption, blue shifted velocities all the way to 2,000 kilometers per second. So we knew that it seemed like the AGN in this object had an influence on scales of a few kiloparsecs. This is 2 kiloparsecs here. So we went back to this object and a few others doing IFU data. And so zooming in on the center of this particular object. So this, again, on the right is the artistic rendition of this object. On the left, much less interesting, are the data. But for spectroscopists, it's actually quite, the velocities are really quite amazing. None of these velocities are redshifted. It goes from minus 300 kilometers per second to minus 1500 kilometers per second. Again, this is the sodium in absorption, so there's really no ambiguity that the material is in front of the source and moving in our direction at that sort of velocities. And so in this picture, we're actually looking at the object face on from the top, and the outflow is basically in our direction. It's a wide-angle outflow. We don't see any particular velocity gradients, except perhaps for this little area that might be affected by the jet. But the jet in this object is only seen on small scale. It's not seen on large scale. So we don't actually know what the jet is doing. It's not clear that it actually goes that far. So the outflow is a wide-angle outflow with velocity in excess of 1,000 kilometers per second. The mass outflow rate is fairly modest, sort of star formation rate. The mechanical energy, because the velocities are so large, though, is quite large. Larger than what the starburst can provide. It's a lower limit. These numbers are lower limits, basically because we run out of galaxy. This is seen against the galaxy, in absorption against the galaxy, and the galaxy gets too faint. And so this number, in terms of the size of the outflow, is a lower limit, and therefore all these numbers are also lower limits. The momentum injection rate is quite a bit larger than the starburst can provide. And so we concluded in this paper and also in a more recent paper that the AGN is playing a role in this object. And then finally, the last thing I wanted to mention about the neutral material, again, in this more recent paper where we studied half a dozen objects, still very small statistics, there might be a trend for outflowing velocity increasing with EGN luminosity. There's various ways of measuring the velocity of these outflows, since these are two-dimensional outflows. Either the maximum velocity, 98th percentile, or 50th percentile. We see trends that above a certain luminosity of, in this case, 11.7 or so, the velocity, especially the ionized gas, is moving quite a bit more than with objects with EG luminosity below that threshold. But I put question mark because it's really very small number of statistics. There's a new paper by Ribas that actually bring credence to this idea. Now, let me switch to the molecular wind, and I'll compare what I just mentioned about the neutral wind. And we actually have more statistics on the molecular winds, where we actually see this trend better. Again, if we go back in time, go back to 2005, the only thing we knew about molecular winds is basically this picture. All about M82, the cold molecular wind from OVRO data on the left, and also we knew that there was dust entrained in the wind that was scattering the UV radiation. That was about it. And it's really changed in 9 years, dramatically. First, of course, there was a Spitzer that came along and detected poly emissions, so warm dust, on similar scale as what is seen in the ionized material, so 3 kiloparsecs or so above and below the disk. And then a few years later, Herschel detected the coal dust, a paper by Roussel and collaborators, basically on similar scale. This is Alex McCormick at Maryland, along with Dave Rupke. We look back at the archival data, which is beautiful archival data from Spitzer, and basically detected this sort of warm dust in all the galaxies we looked at. And there's a correlation between how much material, how much star formation density, star formation rate density, versus the scale height of the extraplanar dust. We saw, using 16 objects or so, a correlation between the scale height of the material elevated above the disk and the star formation rate density. A similar result actually was found recently using UV data from SWIFT, UV-OTT data. Similarly, we see coal dust in wind galaxies in basically all the objects that we've observed. This is going very deep, about factor 10 deeper in sensitivity than the key projects. This is one example, NGC 1569, a dwarf galaxy. This is the star. And you can see basically there's a halo of material that has been entrained in the wind that we know has a beautiful, powerful wind. And basically the filaments that we see here are similar to what we see in H-alpha. So the ionized material also has plenty of dust material entrained in the same process. The warm molecular wind, again, go back to M82, has also been detected. The previous picture was the cold molecular wind. This is the warm molecular wind on temperature of 1,000 degrees or 2,000 degrees. Again, basically on the same scale as, in fact, extending a bit further than the cold molecular wind. And one can play a game about the excitation of this, the rho vibrational line. So this is very simple near-infrared imaging of M82, just exposing for an hour. We actually went on a bit longer than that, but we basically detected this warm wind fairly easily with a 4-meter class telescope. So one might ask the question, why bother doing the cold molecular wind when you can actually observe the warm molecular winds on actually even larger scale, very similar resolution, perhaps actually better if we do a larger telescope. In an hour. And so the answer is really that the warm molecular wind is just a tracer of this molecular outflow. All the material is in this cold component, 10 to the 8 versus 10 to the 4. Now, the warm molecular wind is actually a good tracer, though. And that's something to keep in mind when I'll discuss the cold molecular outflows in these ULURGs. We can use perhaps the warm molecular material, which is easier to observe and have good spatial scale, to constrain what is also going on with the cold molecular material. So it's a good lesson. So most of the work that has been done on the molecular material is the cold phase, because that's where all the material is. That's the one that is important for the dynamics of the winds. And so there's some work now that has started to come out of ALMA. This is one of the paper where Eve and Alberto Bolatto is the PI. And so this is on the nearest starburst galaxies seen from the south. M82, of course, would be a prime target. Unfortunately, it's in the north. And so the focus here is on the nearest starburst galaxy in the south, visible with ALMA. And basically, we see something similar to what is seen in M82, where the CO, shown in contour here, wraps around and follow the warm material, which is shown in yellow. And while the blue is the X-ray hot material that is just volume filling. And the numbers we derive from these data, which is really cycle zero, so it's only 16 telescope out of 64. And so it's really snapshots type of observation. The mass loading factor of this starburst galaxy is 1 to 3. And using fairly conservative assumption on the H2 to CO ratio. Now, so this is not too surprising. And so going back to the more extreme objects, where the star formation rate, and there's actually a quasar at the center, Mark 231, so in 2010, sort of pushing the limit of the current array, URAM, Ferraglio and Marlino observe in CO 1 to 0, the simplest observation, and obviously a dominant narrow component, but it was also detected as these wings, which extends to minus 750 kilometers per second and plus 750 kilometers per second. But they were able to resolve those wings on scales of kiloparsecs, 3 kiloparsecs. And so the moment one has a scale, one can then derive not only the mass that is involved in this offflow, again using fairly conservative values for the H2 to CO, but also derive a mass outflow rate, and that's the mass outflow rates that they derive. So comparing that with the star formation rate, one gets a loading factor of 5, which perhaps becomes a bit uncomfortable for star formation. And this outflow basically was confirmed not only with CO, but various other transition here. And this picture shows the blue wing is extended on scales of 3 kiloparsecs or so, while the red wing doesn't seem to be well resolved. Now, at the same time, this is 2010, Jackie Fisher and collaborators, this is from the Shining Survey, the first results from Herschel, the discovery again in this Marking 231 object of a massive outflow, again a beautiful P-Cygni profile where the velocity extends beyond 1,000 kilometers per second, minus 1,000 kilometers per second. Oh, I guess the scale is inverted here. So again, unambiguous signature of an outflow, where the molecular gas now is being ejected out of the center of the galaxy at 1,000 kilometers per second. So a year later, we extended the sample to 7 targets. ARP220 is also part of the sample. It's not shown in this picture. And we observe more than one transition. And a bit to our surprise, we detected also P-Cygni profiles in many of these objects, the more extreme of these objects. And so we did the simple in this paper in 2011. We just try to estimate basically the velocity of these outflow, at least the maximum velocity of the outflow. And this is what we published a few years ago. And so basically, we said there's no correlation between the outflow, the maximum outflow velocity, and the star formation rate. The molecular outflow doesn't seem to know about the star formation. On the other end, we We also pointed out that perhaps there is a correlation with AGN luminosity, but this was only based on 7 objects. We had 3 lines, OH lines, and so one can play the game of comparing the profile of these 3 lines. And this actually puts a constraint on where this material is. Where is this absorbing material relative to the continuum source? And so going through radio transfer models by Gonzalez and Alfonso, one can actually put a constraint on the size of where the material is, the absorbing material. So once we have a size, then we can derive the mass alpha rates. So the mass alpha rates that we derive from these models were shown here, m dot divided by star formation rate. So many of them, 4 of them, were of order unity. But there's a few objects, 3 of them, had really extreme DMDT over star formation rate. Again, this mass loading factor of factor 10 to 20. So really quite large and uncomfortably large for being driven by star formation. The momentum injection rate for the more extreme objects are up to 20 to 30 also, compared with the radiation pressure from the AGN. The depletion time scale, simply the gas mass divided by mass alpha rates, and that's shown here in years as a function of AGN luminosity. Some of these objects have a depletion time scale of only a few million years, or 10 million years. So they're efficient at removing the fuel, at least in the central part of these objects. I should mention that the size that were derived from these radio transfer models are on the scales of 100 parsecs to 200 parsecs. So we're not talking about 10 kiloparsecs. We're talking only about kiloparsecs or subkiloparsecs. Well, for the neutral gas, it ranged from a few hundred parsecs to a bit beyond that, up to 5 kiloparsecs in some cases. So whether or not it's actually going to quench star formation is another issue. The material is ejected out, but we don't know how far it goes. It might just rain back and produce star later on. In a more recent paper, basically, we look at a few objects. This is one of them, where we have multiple transition, where we can actually do a better job at constraining the size of these outflow in this paper in 2014. And basically, just the bottom line is the number that we get for the mass outflow rates using more constraint from these various transition is very similar to the number that we published in 2011, giving us a bit more confidence that we were not completely wrong. I mean, the error bars on these mass alpha rates are probably of order 3, plus or minus, depending on the object, perhaps a bit more, 3 to 4. We also tried to improve in terms of sample size, and so we expanded the sample to 43 objects in this paper last year, led by a postdoc at Maryland, Marcio Melendez. And basically, we confirm the fact that we see P-Cygni profiles or blue-shifted wings in absorption in many of these objects. Unfortunately, when the AGN is completely dominant, it becomes an emission, and we can't really use this tool of constraining the outflow. It becomes ambiguous. So here the velocity that we measured, again, from this sample of about 43 objects. So the bulk velocity is of order minus 200 kilometers per second, and the maximum velocity is close to 1,000 kilometers per second. These numbers are actually quite similar to what we had derived, both Crystal and our group have derived for the neutral gas. So using the same criteria that we use for the neutral gas, for the definition of a wind, if we use a V50 absorption less than minus 50, we found that there are winds are detected in 70% of the object, implying that the outflow is a wide-angle outflow, perhaps consistent with essentially all these objects having an outflow. On the other end, we very rarely see infall where the velocity is larger than 50 kilometers per second. You know, significant infall only seen in 4 objects, implying that it's just not present or it's not pro with this OH hydroxyl molecule, or as a more filamentary structure. The kinematics, perhaps surprisingly, we didn't find any significant correlation between the OH velocity, the star formation rate, the stellar velocity dispersion, or the stellar mass. On the other hand, there's a caveat in the sense that the sample that we have has a relatively narrow range in these properties of order 1 dec. Now, I wanted to remind you that the neutral gas, the correlation that we see with the neutral gas, involve this property over 1.5, 2, even 3 decs. And so perhaps it's not surprising we don't see a correlation given that we don't have a broad range of these properties in this particular sample. But that's going to change soon. A trend is present with AGN fraction, the fraction of the bulletin luminosity that's produced by the AGN. But a stronger trend is present with AGN luminosity, and that's shown here, where this is V centroid, V50, and V84. Basically, all the objects with the more extreme velocity, more negative than -600 km/s or -700 km/s, all have AGN luminosity larger than 10^11.8. That's also true for the V84, more extreme than 750 km/s. So it seems to indicate that the agent is driving, but the agent has to be powerful enough. If the agent has luminosity larger than of order 11.8, then we start to see an influence on the molecular outflow. The molecular outflow see an indication that the agent is influencing, is playing a role. I'll skip this part. I wanted to also point out a new result from Claudia Ciccone, which was mentioned earlier this afternoon, where we look at 7 additional ULURGs that were not published, and 4 of those at spatially resolved outflow. And in fact, the object that Crystal showed was not one of them. It's not a clear detection, we said, but these 4 objects had a clear detection of outflows. We combine that with objects in the literature, and basically we confirm many of the results that we had found with Herschel in terms of masses, also in terms of mass outflow rate correlated with AGN luminosity above a certain threshold. So strong evidence for AGN driving, for AGN luminosity above a certain threshold. And then also the momentum injection rate being quite large compared with the AGN luminosity. These are basically starburst dominated objects, so they have a very high number for this equation. But even for objects that are dominated by the AGN, this ratio is of order 20. Again, similar to what we had seen in the Herschel results. The other thing that we started doing is using ground-based telescope is to use the warm molecular gas, again going back to this analogy that we saw with M82, where the molecular gas, the warm molecular gas, is a good tracer of molecular gas in general. And so for one particular object, we observed with Keck with laser adaptive optics, laser guided, and so using exquisite resolution to be able to probe the warm molecular gas on the same scale as the cold molecular winds that we detected with Herschel, which is 100 or 200 parsecs. And so most of the warm molecular gas is just in rotation, but there's a component here that is outflowing at a velocity that is very similar to what we saw in the Herschel data. This is sort of a comparison between the Herschel data in red and the H2 in black. So similar velocity. What was also surprising and perhaps comforting is the fact that this outflow has a very similar scale as the outflow that we derive from Herschel, 200 parsecs or so. It also has an opening angle that is consistent with the opening angle that we derive from Herschel data. So again, it adds support that the data, the results, so the conclusion that we got from Herschel data, are consistent with what we see from the warm molecular gas and also from the cold CO ERAM data. So I think I only have 1 minute left, so I'll just skip the high redshift, except to say that obviously things are a lot harder at high redshift, and one cannot use CO120, one has to go with the high excitation line, which are fainter. There's a tentative detection of molecular outflow at redshift 2.8, but it really is very hard work. This was with Iram. There's perhaps the best case of a high redshift outflow is by Molino, but that's using carbon 2, not the molecular component. But the mass alpha rates derive are very large, 3,500 solar masses per year, using fairly conservative assumption here. Obviously, ALMA is the future, and that's just starting again. Basically, a snapshot with ALMA detected a possible outflow off of a quasar. That's the quasar, a velocity field. And this little speck here is a possible outflow coming out of the quasar. But again, in the next few years, this is really going to change. Okay, so let me summarize the result. So the basic properties of molecular winds is that they are detected in 70% of local ULURGs. That implies that these molecular winds are a very wide angle. The velocities are the maximum velocity up to 1,000 kilometers per second on average, or so 900 kilometers per second. These are fairly similar to what we see in the neutral gas. Here are the energetics that we derive from Urschel and also now from Iram, where the DMDT up to 1,000 solar masses per year is detected in a few objects. And here are the numbers for the mechanical energy and the total mechanical energy. And some of the results from ground base gives us some confidence that these numbers are not are fairly accurate to within a factor of 3 or so, 4. And then finally, just purely empirically, we just look at the velocity, the kinematic trends, measuring the velocity without making any assumption, suggests that the above a certain threshold of order 11.8, that the agent is starting to play a role. So basically, this is a luminosity of a quasar, a minimum luminosity of a quasar. And this threshold probably only applies to local ULURGs. It probably depends on the gas fraction, depends on the size of these galaxies as well. So most likely, this AGN threshold luminosity would be different at higher redshift and for SMGs, etc. I'll leave that open question at the end as a discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Sylvain. Are there any questions on this?
Yep. So the argument that the detection rate of 70% or maybe even higher, meaning that the opening angle is very wide, does it also mean that the filling factor is very high and you don't think the gas is very clumpy, the molecular gas even?
Well, I think the gas is definitely clumpy, but there could be several clumps along the way also.
So lots of small.
Lots and lots of, okay, of clouds, so that the probability of intercepting the material, the absorbing material, is very high.
Yep.
So I tend to think of molecules as being sort of fragile things out there in the universe. How do you get them to 1,000 kilometers a second and not destroy them? Are they being formed out there, or are they being, can you drive them up to those velocities?
No, it's absolutely a good question. I think I should give it back to the theorists in the audience. There's a lot of expertise here. So the scale is 100 parsecs, so we're not talking about very large scale. But you're quite right. So some of the issues here that I pointed out, I mean, there's a number of papers that suggest that it's actually being formed along the way, so you don't have that problem of survival or erosion, where basically the material is compressed and has sufficient density to basically form molecular gas, perhaps even form stars. That's also been suggested. And so that could prevent these problems of survival. But it is surprising. It's really unexpected.
Yeah, Kristen?
On the OH outflows in the ULURGs, can you say a little more about how you get the mass there, how you go from the OH to the total molecular mass, and how is it factors of two uncertainty or more? Or?
Yeah, so the numbers that we put in that paper, 2011, also the same thing for the more recent Gonzalez-Alfonso, use actually conservative number, because one has to make an assumption about to go from OH to H2. And we use the most conservative assumption, the most extreme case in the galaxy, and to get the smallest H2 mass. So we use 5×10⁻⁶ for the 2011 paper. And so, I mean, that's obviously directly proportional to that number. But we try to be conservative. The error bars that we put in 2011 was a factor of 4 plus or minus on average.
So as a person who works in star formation theory primarily, and over the years having seen how the subject of massive star formation has worked out, in which you see very rapid energetic jets being emitted, disks are involved, wide-angle molecular flows, not so well collimated up here. There's just it sitting in the audience and listening to your talk is a case of almost deja vu for me. So on the question of driving, is it clear for the people that presented models in this audience that the supernova-driven activity is capable of driving the jets that you see? Has that been nailed down in the models would be a first question. And the second question is, a highly collimated jet at the center of this, say the AGN case would be a natural suggestion, is that capable of driving these wide angle flows? Again, that's more of a theory question, but do you have data that might tack that
down?
So
in nearly all of these objects, there's no evidence of a jetted outflow from radio. What Mark 231 is the poster child, there is a jet on small scale, VLBI scale, but we don't actually know exactly what this jet does on larger scale. What we know is there is bubble on very large scale. And so what might be happening, and I think that's not unreasonable, is that this jet actually does some work and it deposits some energy on parsec scale and isotropies, you know, deposit its kinetic energy, and then it just blow a bubble through the molecular disk. Because this alpha, this wide-angle alpha that we detect, is perpendicular to the molecular disk. And so I think what is going on in this object, and perhaps in a few other objects, is a jet is depositing energy on small scale and then produce the wider angle alpha on larger scale.
Yeah, we have time for one more question.
So when you say cold molecular gas and warm molecular gas, what's the temperature of cold and warm?
Well, we actually didn't measure it directly. Well, there's some constraints for a few objects, but it's a few tens of degrees. It depends actually, so, and for the warm molecular gas, the wind material, that we have a bit of a better constraint. This is from the Rho vibrational line, and the number were shown here. So the wind material, the temperature of the wind material from the H2 ratio is larger, so 2400 degrees, versus the material in the disk in rotation at the top. So the wind actually, you know, the material in the wind knows that it's in the wind. It's a bit more highly excited than the material in rotation in the disk.
And the cold molecular gas, the temperature?
A few tens of degrees. The constraints are not as good.
A very quick question, maybe? Last question.
Could the wind not just be due to a collection of O and Wolf ray stars? Because you form 1,000 solar masses star formation, so you make something like 20 O stars per year, and they live 5 million years, so you have 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 O stars, so you could blow a wind like that from the O stars and the Wolf ray stars.
The star formation rate is 100 solar masses per year. It's not 1,000 solar masses per year.
It's set somewhere. Oh, well, but even if it's 100, you make 2 O stars per year, so you make 10 to the 7 O stars you have there.
Yeah, I know. I mean, we compare the energy in these winds with E star, from the winds, from the supernova, and it was not enough, even if you assume 100% thermization efficiency. Hmm. So it's hard to push it just with the starboard. There's also the issue of the momentum that we also pointed out. That, if we're talking about radiation pressure, for instance, the starboard certainly doesn't have enough push to drive these winds.